you already know how this will end.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Treisman, who's a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia. He has written two books and numerous articles about the country's development since 1991 and was a consultant to the Russian government in 1997 on tax reform. He is the author of The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, now out in paperback. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Treisman.
Thank you.
And I guess in a way, the subtitle, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, could be amended. Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev to Putin to Medvedev to Putin.
Well, that's right. Yes, things look at the moment as though they're taking a step back. And perhaps I'll have to, in future editions, retitle the book.
So what do you make, though, of the backlash against the last election? The dissident who was arrested is now out again. I think he coined the phrase United Russia, the party of swindlers and thieves,
right.
Seems to have caught on. And there have been massive demonstrations, I think a couple of weekends ago, up to 100,000 people in the streets of Moscow. How sustained do you think is this backlash against United Russia, and I think in particular Putin?
Well, it shows that the middle class, and in particular the middle class in the urban centers, has come of age politically. For a long time, this class has been quite quiescent, willing to accept very little role in politics so long as the economy continued performing well. But now it's very visibly dissatisfied with the way things have been going and willing to get out in the streets. I think there are several factors explaining why we see this upsurge of unrest at this point. One is economic. The global financial crisis has affected politics in countries around the world, and Russia is certainly not excluded from that. So it's been a tough few years. Russia has stabilized its economy to some extent, but still growth is much lower than it was in the preceding 8 years before the crisis, and people are feeling much more insecure. Real incomes didn't rise at all this year and have only risen a little bit since the beginning of the financial crisis. So that's the backdrop for the outrage over this latest election. But of course, the trigger is this sense of real shock at how blatantly the election seems to have been or appears to be manipulated in the major cities like Moscow, where most people think that the results were very far from the way people had actually voted. And that has brought people from the big cities out into the streets.
Well, it seems, Daniel Treisman, your book, The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, it actually, I think, is very helpful in as much as you very sort of painstakingly and systematically explode much of the myths that we have about Russia by comparing Russia to other countries. When you talk about corruption, the freedom of the press, etc., you put it into a much more realistic context. But one of the prevailing notions about Russia is that they're almost genetically predisposed to autocracy, whether it's the Shahs or the communists or now Putin. How much of is that myth being exploded by what's happening now on the streets of Russia?
Well, I hope people are starting to see the country in a new light. In the book, I argue against this tendency that we have and that many Russians also have towards mystification. Towards painting their country as unique, as unknowable, as beyond the grasp of rational observation and analysis. And my view is that Russia is, in fact, another country like many middle-income countries, faces very similar problems from corruption to imperfect democratic practices to economic turbulence. When you compare it to countries like Mexico or Turkey, the similarities are more striking than the differences. I think that's a perspective that we often lose when we think about Russia because it always stands out as sui generis with its writers, its history, its global scope. That perspective, though attractive in some ways, especially to Russians who want to assert the uniqueness of their country, I think is ultimately misleading and makes us see Russia as more frozen in a sort of autocratic frame than it is in fact. And I think these demonstrations show us that quite unexpectedly for many people, a middle class is developing in Russia, and it's a middle class which looks very much like the middle classes in other middle-income countries that are getting richer around the world.
Again, I'm joined in the studio by Daniel Treisman, a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia. He's the author of The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, now out in paperback. Often, of course, Russia's referred to as KGB Incorporated, and as much as Putin has brought in a lot of KGB cronies into government, whether officially or unofficially, and there's a sense that he sort of regulates the oligarchs in a way. But going back to his appointment from out of nowhere, he was a relatively obscure KGB official who served in East Germany, not a prime spot for KGB rising stars. And you mentioned in the book that Yeltsin and those who chose him thought that he could bring the KGB back into the state, and so that it wasn't a rogue organization. So how's that worked out?
Well, obviously, Putin, his background is in the KGB, and he has loyalty towards the KGB and, in general, law enforcement and intelligence. And so he's brought many people from that world into government and into high positions in parts of the state. But I think we need to bear in mind that, especially compared to past KGB alumni, he is really quite an unusual person to come out of that organization. First of all, he is very much committed to markets, to big business, and I think his perspective is really that, to a great extent, of a sort of modern business person. He is extremely interested in the strategy of the gas company Gazprom. He takes a detailed role, quite an interventionist role, in setting economic policy and in helping the business of certain key enterprises. And in part, he's brought friends, or I should say perhaps just acquaintances, people that he's known for a very long time, into important positions in business, in state-owned enterprises, on the boards and so on. At the same time, some other acquaintances in the private sector have done very well. And we can't prove, obviously, that it's due to any favors on his part, but it certainly creates a picture of success for former acquaintances of Putin. So we see someone who's got this loyalty to the KGB, who was formed in the KGB, but is much more modern in outlook, believes in free markets, believes that power in the modern world depends on money, and also somebody who, we shouldn't forget, also worked for one of the leading Democrats in the early 1990s. This was Anatoly Sobchak, who was the mayor of St. Petersburg, and he hired Putin to be a close aide, and Putin worked with him in the early 90s. So from the point of view of the KGB old-timers, when Putin was first appointed, I think there was some nervousness that he was not as much of an insider as many in the West thought, that he was in fact some sort of renegade. How has it worked? Well, we've seen, as everybody has noticed, an increase in the role of the security services and law enforcement in Russian life, and a rolling back of controls over them to some extent. But we've also seen a modernization of Russia in the economy and in various other aspects. So it's been a mixed and complicated path of development. At this point, I think what's striking is the gap that's opened up between the political institutions and the political practices on the one hand, which are really rather archaic at this point, and a society that is far more modern and really demanding the kinds of freedom and participation that modern societies demand everywhere.
So it's not a question of the KGB embracing freedom and Putin by extension. It's really what we're talking about is he's embraced capitalism, not necessarily freedom. And in your book, you point out that Russia is somewhere between freedom and fear.
Exactly. Putin has embraced and his associates have embraced capitalism, but they want to be respected internationally. They understand that one can't simply rule like Stalin in a country like Russia. And Putin has on some occasions hinted that what he was aiming for was something definitely not the kind of society of fear that we saw under Stalin or even Brezhnev in the Soviet Union, but a society in which people are orderly, but not afraid. And they have a lot of personal freedom. This is something which is dramatically different from the Soviet days. There's a tremendous amount of personal freedom in Russia. There's also a vulnerability, because if powerful people decide that they want a firm that you've started or a piece of real estate that you control, then it's very hard to say no, and it can be a dangerous place. But apart from that, there's a great deal of personal freedom, private life, travel. The press is not free in the sense that the main television channels until today, it may be changing a little bit right now, but until very recently have been subservient to the Kremlin and have presented politics and the top leaders in a very positive light. But there are cable news channels, there are radio stations which are harshly critical. There's the internet and many sites which are very much in opposition. All sorts of reporting goes on. And there are some very brave journalists who work on newspapers and magazines, which are extremely critical and do a lot of investigative journalism, which is very impressive. So it's a mixed, complicated situation. It's not a situation in which we can just say it's a totalitarian state or anything like that. It's much more like a country like Mexico, where the army and the police have certain powers. It's not a perfectly liberal society, but at the same time, it's not a society that resembles North Korea or Cuba.
And as your book, Daniel Treisman, The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, points out, the Russian people, while we in the West see Russia as becoming less free under Putin and more authoritarian, they actually see their lives getting freer. And that's notwithstanding the control of state media, because the internet is free. So you have kind of two universes there, it seems. So one of the aspects, though, that I find troubling, of course, is this, the NASHI, the youth group that Kremlin has formed, or United Russia has formed. You know, it's not difficult to sort of see echoes of the Hitler Youth in that, although clearly there's no overriding kind of Nazi philosophy there. I mean, if you listen to Boris Nemtsov's description of them, it's pretty harrowing. I mean, that there's a kind of heartless, mindless kind of materialism that comes out of he refers to them as parasites. How do you describe NASHI?
Well, it's a project of the Kremlin, obviously. I really wouldn't compare it to Hitler Youth. I mean, that's making it seem much grander than it is. It's basically a program under which some money and organizational support has been funneled to some poor kids from poorer regions of the country, along with a lot of propaganda about Putin. And it's like youth groups everywhere. It can be sort of frightening when you listen to how extreme some of the young people sound. On the other hand, we've seen in these recent demonstrations just how ineffective this Kremlin counterpunch can be. In the demonstrations in Moscow, they've bussed in kids from surrounding towns, paid them to beat drums and try and disrupt the democratic protests. And it's failed miserably. So I would say it was an overreaction, a sort of extreme overreaction on the part of the Kremlin to the events in Ukraine in 2004, when protests against an illegitimate election, an election in which there was a lot of fraud, led to the overthrow of the government.
The Orange Revolution.
The Orange Revolution. So at that point, Putin and his aides became worried that something like that might happen in Russia, although at the time it seemed extremely unlikely. And they thought that the way to combat democratic activists in the street is to have your own activists in the street who can go and shout against them. So that was the thinking behind it. It was not some ideological master plan or view of changing, engineering Russian souls or anything like that. It was to have a few shock troops who could go out and do battle in the public squares when the politics seems to be descending into a competition of shouting. And I think it'll fade away quite quickly as the regime ultimately disintegrates.
And you think it will disintegrate? Presidential elections are coming up in March. My understanding from, I spoke a little while ago, at the time of the first big demonstrations with Nina Khrushcheva, the granddaughter of the former Soviet leader, and she mentioned that what offends a lot of the Russian people about Putin was that he'd had a facelift. So how much is his vanity, the sort of cynical musical chairs he's playing with Medvedev, and this idea that, you know, that I'm inevitable, and this patronizing, paternalistic attitude that he appears to have?
Well, I think we need to distinguish different constituencies within Russia. There are the highly educated, sophisticated international traveling Moscow and St. Petersburg elites. And they find Putin's crassness, his insulting comments, his paternalism increasingly hard to take. So this is a major irritation. But for the most of the population that live in smaller towns in the provinces, I think it's been always far less a matter of Putin's personal image and far more a matter of just economic performance. And so long as the economy was doing pretty well, they were happy to keep Putin there to give him the benefit of the doubt. Now, I think gradually, there is a growing sense, even in the provinces, that this regime is extremely corrupt and it doesn't take ordinary people seriously at all. So I think that's gradually changing. But there's a split. So, I mean, all this sort of day-to-day nonsense about, you know, Putin's comments and his riding bare-chested on horses and all this, it's an irritant to the highly educated elites, but it doesn't register so much with the ordinary people.
Well, I suppose in a way, you know, because your book, The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, is a lot about sort of deconstructing some of the myths. And I'm sort of thinking what you're saying here is it's the economy stupid. You know, it's the same thing that Clinton's White House recognized as a political reality and the same thing that the Obama White House is surely going to be running on the economy in this year. But it isn't a very diversified economy. It's an economy that depends upon resources, largely oil and gas. And I know they're trying to diversify it. So what would be Putin's undoing in terms of the economy? How do you see that?
Well, at the moment, experts are quite unsure about the future path of the Russian economy. As you say, it's quite dependent on oil and gas. It's not just a natural resource economy, but clearly that's the main contributor to economic growth. And the situation looks pretty bad in that regard, because many of the oil fields and gas fields that have been important in the last 10, 20 years are gradually drying up. So it's a time when they need massive amounts of investment in order to develop new fields, in order just to keep output up. And that's difficult. They've become much more dependent for budget revenues on a high oil price. So this puts pressure on the fiscal situation. And for all the talk about diversification and modernization, not very much has happened. So I think there's a realization that growth is going to be lower in the next 10 years. It may still be quite reasonable, 3 or 4%, but it's not going to be the 7 or 8% that we saw in the 2000s. And there aren't any easy answers to how to regenerate more rapid growth. I think ultimately it would require major risky reforms in education, in healthcare, in infrastructure, and so on. And I don't see a willingness on the part of this regime, especially as its popularity falls, to take very risky steps.
Well, thank you so much for joining us in the studio, Daniel Treisman.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Treisman, a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia. He has written two books and numerous articles about the country's development since 1991 and was a consultant to the Russian government in 1997 on tax reform. He's the author of The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, now out in paperback. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about what exactly is in the National Defense Authorization Act the president signed last Saturday.
Don't be a criminal in this police state. You better sharpen and procreate. You've got vacation days, then you might escape to a condo on the coast. Set my watch to the atomic clock. I hear the crowd count down till the bomb gets dropped. I always figured there'd be time enough. I never let it get me down.